This episode of the Gospel Coalition podcast is brought to you by Operation Christmas Child. To learn how gift-filled shoeboxes will result in evangelism and discipleship for more than 4 million children this year, visit SamaritansPurse.org/OCC. This is the Gospel Coalition podcast, where we seek to renew the contemporary church in the ancient gospel of Jesus Christ. I'm your host, Colin Hansen. What if I told you thinking more about your own death could be the key to growing now in faith, hope, and love? That's the case Matt McCullough makes in his new book, Remember Death, The Surprising Path to Living Hope, published by Crossway with the Gospel Coalition. Matt earned his PhD at Vanderbilt University and serves as pastor of Trinity Church in Nashville, Tennessee, which he helped plant. You won't find Matt on social media, but you'll occasionally find him writing for the likes of Nine Marks and TGC. I had the privilege of editing this thought-provoking book, which Tom Schreiner has called haunting, profound, and stirring. Andrew Peterson calls it a welcome conversation in a culture that doesn't know how to think about mortality. Indeed, that's why I was so excited about the book when Matt first pitched the idea to me. How can it be that all of us know someday we'll die, and yet we don't talk or think much about it? That can't be a sign of health. If we're going to die, then we need to know what comes next, and we need to live, think, and breathe right now in light of that fact. It's best to know life is fleeting before it's fled. Matt joins me on the Gospel Coalition podcast to talk about death, hope, grief, and living in light of the end. Matt, thanks for joining me on the Gospel Coalition podcast.
Hey, Colin. Glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
All right. So you say this is not a book about how to prepare for death, so much as a book about what acknowledging death means for our lives now. What's the difference?
Yeah, I really try to emphasize that, partly so people get a little truth in advertising. There are a couple different ways to talk about death as a Christian, not just now, books being written now, but a long tradition of writing about death that stems back to the early days of the church. One of those, often called Ars Moriendi, or the art of death, is about how to prepare for the moment, the experience of death, how to fight for faith in the midst of it. That is absolutely not what this book is, not because I think it's not relevant for people who are facing death. I hope it is. I hope it'll be encouraging to them. But because that kind of book requires a lot of experience that I just frankly don't have from my own life or from my own ministry. My book falls in another stream, often called Memento Mori or Remember Death. That stream is about perspective, about living life day to day in light of the fact that our lives don't last forever. This is the sort of perspective that came naturally to Christians in other times and places, but that I believe has been largely lost in contemporary American Christianity that I know and experience. I think that the loss of it has hurt us in a lot of ways. I try to explain in the book. What I'm trying to do is reintroduce to those of us who maybe have stopped thinking about it or never really thought much about it, what sort of problem death actually is. So the Memento Mori tradition, the Remember Death tradition, focuses on death, gives it a close reading, pays attention to the places it shows up in life, and then uses that awareness to leverage our hope that Jesus has come to conquer it for us, since we have no hope apart from that.
Is this just, I think a lot of people are just struck that this feels morbid. Mm-hmm. I mean, why isn't that what technology has protected us from? That we don't have to think about death, that mm-hmm. we can delay it as long as possible. It's possible now to even live into your 70s and mm-hmm. pretend like it's not coming.
Yeah.
I think this requires a pretty significant paradigm shift. Why should we be thinking about death if we spend just untold amounts of money as a culture so that death doesn't have to happen to us?
Yeah. Well, because we're experiencing it. Whether we like to admit it or recognize it or not, death is an everyday experience for people. A lot of times we just misdiagnose what we're dealing with. So absolutely, we have opportunities now. Thanks to the wonderful achievements of modern medicine, we have opportunities to push the experience and even the conscious awareness of death further back into our lifespan than anybody ever has. And thanks be to God for that. I mean, what a gift that life expectancy is twice what it was 100 years ago. But we've used this extra space that modern medicine has given us to participate, I think, all too often in a kind of unspoken agreement to deny the truth that life doesn't end. And that repression, if you will, it can give us a false sense of control over our lives that has us spinning our wheels trying to build lives that we think will bring us satisfaction that they can't under the shadow of death.
So let's put some of this into practice. And I have been talking about this for years now, actually, and been working on this project together.
Yeah. Yeah.
But help apply this to me. So I was reading an interesting book I'm still in the process of reading. It's called The Happiness Hypothesis. It's by Jonathan Haidt, evolutionary psychologist. And he's diagnosing different personalities and whatnot, and I just get hit straight between the eyes. He's talking about some people are genetically predisposed to not being happy. And one of the reasons they're genetically predisposed that way is because they have striver mentalities to life. They are always looking for a new challenge. They are always trying to meet new goals. They're incredibly ambitious people. Mm-hmm. I imagine you might know some people like that, right, being next to Vanderbilt University there. There might be some of those people in your church. So that's why I'm thinking you might be able to help counsel me. But then it just sort of hits me that he's saying this correlates to a significant amount of unhappiness because you can't arrive. Like there's no way to ever achieve that goal that you set out to, because there will always be another mountain to climb. Help me to understand how your book brings some perspective to that problem as I'm trying to work through that. Cause I mean, I'm approaching middle age. I guess if you use 40 as kind of a classic middle age, and I don't know if this is how these kind of midlife crises happen, but it seems like we're always preparing for something. It's like you're always preparing in life. And then by the time you realize that you've like missed out on something, or it's never going to happen or whatever, maybe that's the midlife crisis there. So how does just remembering our death bring perspective and even hope into situations like this that I experience?
I mean, that is the question for my own life, much less for the lives of the folks that I love and pastor, and for what you're experiencing in your life. I think it's a great example of the kind of awareness that I'm trying to argue for in the book. So what I'd say to the striver who hasn't recognized yet that there is no arriving is, first of all, it's worse than you think it is. So then I could help them see it's better than you think it is. So I think that death awareness helps us see that the problem isn't what we haven't reached yet in this life. A lot of times we do live that way, especially again when death has been pushed to the margins of our experience, and we are allowed to look at more short-term tomorrows and fill them with all sorts of hopes and dreams that we work towards, that orient our lives, give us purpose and a promise of meaning, and we start working at those tomorrows. Tomorrow is the object of our highest hopes. It's a friend, we think. When death awareness is something that you cultivate intentionally, you learn to recognize that this is just not true. It's not how tomorrow works, that what it looks like to arrive always ends in death. If we're talking about life under the sun, if we're roping Jesus out of it and just looking at what it is to live life in the world as we know it, then the only place you ever fully arrive is your own grave.
I mean, I love family history. I just love history in general. That's one reason why you and I get along so well. And I think it's probably common for a lot of people who love history to maybe want some significance for themselves, to be remembered themselves. One of the ways that I try to work through this popularly, sometimes as a check against my ambitions, is to ask people the names of their great-grandparents. I mean, very few people can remember any of them.
Yeah.
That's not that far away.
Yeah. I mean, no kidding.
you would think nothing of remembering your grandparents if you've been privileged to be able to grow up around them. But almost every single one of my seven grandparents, great-grandparents, was alive. And I actually do know who they were in many cases and all that. But when you talk to people, they just don't. They don't remember.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. What if I did remember? Or what if we all did remember them? What if someday I would be remembered? Here's what I can't figure out, Matt. What difference would it make to me? I'm dead.
Yeah, right.
I mean, how is that supposed to change anything?
Right. Yeah, it's a small consolation, isn't it?
Right. So I'm trying to understand, if I leave behind incredible wealth, if I leave behind an incredible reputation, if I leave behind all these buildings, the pyramids or whatever, what good does it do me? So I'm wondering, does that fit in your grid of it's worse than you think, but then it's better than you think? Because does that not indicate at least some kind of human desire for immortality that actually Christ offers us?
Yeah.
Not the remembrance of ourselves, but a time that never ends.
Yes, absolutely, brother. That is exactly what that tells us about ourselves. I don't think that that it will ever be enough for us to be remembered. Even if we knew we would live on the memory of our descendants, it's like you're saying, it's still not enough. We want more than that. And we were made to. And it's also beautifully tailored to the promises that Jesus has made to us of an identity joined to him that's as permanent and secure as his. Names that are graven in his hands and known and beloved by a Father who redeemed us.
So instead of maybe the striver personality that is a little bit more typical of some of our ministry contexts and maybe personal life, let's try the other end of the spectrum. Why not eat, drink, and be merry? If tomorrow we die, death awareness, why not eat, drink, and be merry?
I think that's one possible coping mechanism. That's certainly a way to sort of a kind of palliative care, if you will, for the time that you've got left. But it isn't enough for some of the reasons you were saying a moment ago. I mean, that there's just something in us that knows better. The eat, drink, be merry it sounds a lot better when you're 20 years old, 25, 30 even, when you've got a little disposable income in your pocket and a lot of opportunities out in front of you. I don't know what you say to the stage 4 cancer patient who's 85. That they're going to need something different. And the difference between the 25-year-old who's got his life out in front of him and the 85-year-old with stage 4 cancer is a breath of air, man. It's a breath of air.
Oh, that's helpful. Let's talk about this remembering death as a spiritual discipline. What does this look like beyond the generic awareness? How does this enter into our lives in a regular basis that begins to foster that?
Well, I think that when I say in the book that I think of it as a sort of spiritual discipline, I'm acknowledging it's different from things like prayer, from fasting, from scripture memorization, partly because it's not as obviously an activity. I'm looking for a certain perspective here on life that recognizes where death shows up. But it is a spiritual discipline in the sense that spiritual disciplines are those practices that the Bible calls us to. So I'm thinking here of Psalm 90, calling us to number our days, and that are meant to help us engage our lives to God, to experience his goodness in day-to-day life. So I think what I'm arguing for is learning to recognize where death shows up, because everywhere it does, once we throw that proper label onto it, we've got an opportunity to enjoy the resurrection of Jesus in our lives. So every experience of loss is also an opportunity to hope, to long for the restoration and renewal of everything that Jesus has promised us. If we dull the pain of loss through some other way, through maybe looking to something else we could acquire, you know, through some new purchase or some new pleasurable experience, you know, to sort of take our minds off of it. Well, that might work for a little while, but we've just missed an opportunity to understand why Jesus talks about eternal life so much, why he promises to satisfy us in a way nothing else ever has, because he can give us something that won't end. So what I'm trying to do in the book is show you, here are some places that you're already experiencing death and maybe haven't known to call it that, so that you can see it when it happens. And then trying to pair up promises that Jesus has made to us that come to life in light of these specific problems that death brings. So that you can just learn new instincts. So it's a new diagnosis, I think, a new diagnostic process, if you will.
I wonder, Matt, if the very circumstances for which we give so much thanks have actually made us fools in this regard, have made us ignore what is so plainly true about us. And I wonder, these promises of eternal life, I wonder about this. Have we succumbed so much to an expressive individualist and of authentic pursuit that the promises of eternal life just don't mean that much to us? I mean, I'm wondering if in previous generations there never would have been the expectation mm-hmm. that this life can fulfill in ways that we expect it to fulfill us now. Our work, our relationships, our entertainment. I mean, just you could go down the list, and what we seek to squeeze out of all of these things is so different from what other generations expected.
Yeah, I absolutely think that's true. I think that we just have opportunities for comfort and pleasure that God has given us. We're thankful for that. That weren't possible for a lot of the people in other times and places, and just like the Bible has taught us to expect, we tend to make idols out of good things God gives us. We tend to disorient ourselves in our enjoyment of those things by forgetting where they come from and by putting them into the wider context of wisdom and what we know about the world and how it works. So I think you're absolutely onto something there. There's a chapter in the book where I try to make some of those connections and talk about another book written by a really insightful writer, Barry Schwartz, called The Paradox of Choice. He talks in that book about how we have all of these choices for what to fill our lives with that others couldn't have imagined, but that the scale of these choices, the sheer number of them, makes us much less likely to be satisfied with whatever choice we make, because we're always looking at what other people have, what choices they made, what we might have had if we made a different choice, and it can poison our joy in what we do have just because of all the other options that are out there.
And so your perspective on remembering death enters into this paradox of choice and says the choices that you make right here that feel like all of your happiness and fulfillment and everything hinges on them, ultimately, they don't really matter.
Yeah.
I mean, they matter in some sense, but they end the same way.
That Jesus is the only thing that can make them matter. Our union with Christ, our funneling of all of our work into the stream of what he has done is the only way they matter. So one choice over another one, in to use Schwartz's categories, is probably not going to deliver in the way you think. I use it in the book. I use it as an example of how contentment can be so much more difficult for us now, because there's so many other options. We can always wonder the what ifs. We can always compare to what others have. And how death awareness can be a powerful tool in the fight for contentment, something as simple as that. Because one healthy thing to do, I think, if you look carefully at the book, you'll notice I like images that are kind of jarring and in your face. So here's another one. To fight for contentment, to use death awareness in that fight, think about two different airplanes making a transatlantic flight. Think about one of them being a private plane with luxury leathers and full bar and chef prepared food. Think of the other one being like a military transport jet, you know, just those canvas seats that flip down and the uncomfortable harnesses you got to strap into, and there's no noise control. I mean, if you're just comparing those two planes and experience of flying on them, then there's a lot of reason for discontent if you're stuck on the military transport jet and you're looking over there at what others are enjoying on that fancy private jet. But if you consider the fact that both of those jets are going down, that both of them are going to end in the same Atlantic Ocean on the bottom of that ocean floor, well, then you're not really concerned about whether you're sitting on canvas or leather. You're not thinking about those things, right? I mean, the reality of death levels those two experiences and makes, well, it doesn't necessarily yet make contentment possible, but at least fights against discontent. And so once you use death to kind of come in and clear away the discontent problem, make discontent look foolish, I think it's used the categories of the Bible, then you can fight for contentment with the promises of the gospel. You come back behind what death has brought you to recognize with the promise that Christ is satisfying in a way nothing else could be, with the promise that he gives good gifts to his own and is the best gift of all, and that his goodness is a gift that's there for the taking for anyone who will trust in him. So that's the kind of process that I'm trying to lay out. Death awareness as clearing the ground that then allows the beauty and the power of Christ's promises to thrive.
Not to mention that
absolutely,
one day his
promise above
that death
all
will be
that, everything depends on the resurrection. But that seems so abstract to those who think they're immortal. Like, what good is resurrection to someone who's not dying? So what I'm trying to do is help you to recognize that you are dying so that you can see just how wonderful it is that Christ promises life to those who join to him.
Is this how you then see death awareness as being effective in evangelism? Because when you first start talking about how this can be helpful for evangelism, I'm thinking hell houses?
No, I don't think
that's what you have in mind. So help me understand a little bit of that. Because one thing that's interesting here is that your book actually is not focused on talking about hell. That's not really what you're trying to address here. You're just talking about death, just the reality of death and how all of us are in that same boat. And in a sense, we're all on one of those planes there. So help connect that then to what this would look like.
The Hell House image is a great one for what I'm not trying to do here. And not because I don't believe that hell is real and actually a far greater problem than the reality of physical death. I mentioned this in the introduction and certainly do believe in that and preach that. And yet, I think that in my experience of American Christianity, the problem of death, the physical reality of it that's accessible and experienced by everyone, Christian or not, has been undersold. The importance of it has been undersold. So, when I was a kid, I remember training on some evangelism techniques that would involve death awareness, right? If you were to die tonight and you were to stand before God and he was to ask you, why should I let you into heaven, what would you say? I think that that's a fully acceptable thing to do. But I think that's a kind of death awareness that assumes people see death as a pathway to judgment that they already fear. In my pastoral context now, and really in my own faith, my own experience of doubt about my faith, and then pastoring people who know that there are other options and live with those other options as real pulls that they feel, that live as if there other religions could bear as much truth content as Christianity or no religion at all. I'm seeing the value of death awareness in a different way. So by focusing simply on the reality of death, I think what we're appealing to an experience that's accessible to all people everywhere, no matter what they assume about God. And if we can help affect them with this condition, with the horror of it, the devastating effect that it has on life. In other words, if we can use death awareness to sort of topple over things they otherwise might have thought gave their lives meaning, then we can clear the ground for the gospel to take root. So sociologist Peter Berger talked about in his book, The Sacred Canopy, about where religion comes from. He talks about religions as getting their power on the credibility of the banners that religion puts in the hands of men as they stand before death. This is a quote from Berger. Or more accurately, as they walk inevitably toward it. So the credibility of the banners that religions put in the hands of men as they stand before death. I think that's a wonderful way to think about what religions that own up to the name, or more secular versions that are still just as religious, are trying to do. They're fighting for meaning that can't be erased by death. So if we can use an honest, sober, straightforward talk about what death does to life, we can use death to topple over those hopes one by one. Camus talked about death as exposing the things we look to in life for meaning as no more than set pieces on a stage. You know, from a distance, you look at them, they look like they're heavy. They've got some substance to them. Looks like a real tree or a real wall or a real roof. But you get up there closer, you take a look behind them, and you realize that it's just some plywood propped up by 2x4s, easy to push over. Well, death awareness helps us to push over false gods that we might otherwise trust in. And then pushing those over allows us to bring in Christ as the solution to the thing we've just helped someone else understand they need. What I love about death awareness is that I think it is an accessible common ground, no matter what you think about the world, that meets up with explicit promises of Jesus, who pitches himself as the resurrection and the life, which is then in turn supported by some of the clearest and most compelling historical evidence for the truth of Christianity, the fact of Jesus' resurrection. So there's this vortex or confluence of things, a common ground place to start with death awareness and the promises Jesus makes to the need we've exposed, and then the evidence supporting his resurrection that I think is really useful, certainly helps me fight for my own faith and protect it in times of doubt. And I'm seeing some fruit from it in ministering to people who are struggling too.
Do you think that's why?
That's right.
And yep. You're right next to the medical center there, right? As well. So I find it is a little easier to be able to talk to folks in the medical community about this. And that probably connects back to a fact that we didn't talk about early on, but is quite prominent in there. That one of the, in your book is that one reason we don't talk about death is because we don't physically see it very often, because it's cordoned off in our hospitals. So the nurses and doctors and therapists and all these other people, they are the ones who continue to see it. And I wonder, do you think that what you're talking about there with the common ground in, and especially as we see in some of these medical professions, is one reason why we're seeing some of the only popular level cultural moment writing about death coming from these doctors?
Maybe so. I think that could be some of it. Though the phenomenon, when we think about books that are about death that are really popular and sell a lot of copies, the thing that sticks out to me about those books, even more than that many of them have been written by doctors who see death up close, is that probably even more of them have been written by people who are facing death. They're in the memoir genre. And so what I'm trying to do is trying to say one of the downsides of the fact that death, writing on death, is coming from people who see it every day in the medical profession or who are facing it themselves in their own lives, is that either way, for those who aren't doctors or for those who aren't imminently facing death, death comes off as some sort of exotic experience that you only have if you're in the right place at the right time or under the terrible, unfortunate circumstances, when in fact it's not exotic at all. It's inevitable and universal.
Yeah. So I remember early on, as you and I talked through this, I was trying to make these same connections that I'm making right here.
Yeah.
And I said, it's fascinating. There seems to be a lot written by people, best-selling books being written by people. That's exactly the point you made to me, though. You said, it's still interesting because it's not expected.
Mm-hmm.
Like that, there's a novelty aspect to it. When we think about people who've died too young, there's a sense there's just a fascination, a sense of injustice. This never should have happened.
Yeah.
But it still doesn't connect back to the only difference between me and that person is breath, a short amount of time.
Yeah.
And, and perhaps why we see a lot of moral and spiritual clarity coming from some of those.
Yes, absolutely.
Is because they're the only ones who are forced with time to be able to do death awareness.
Yeah.
And also then, you know, connected to that, the death preparation that you referred to
earlier.
You know, another thing that we didn't mention, but I think you were probably trying to allude to earlier here in my last question, is that you pastor a very young church.
Yeah.
As far as I know, still never done a funeral. Is that right?
Not of a member who's died. Yeah.
Not of a member. Okay. Of that church. So help us understand what death awareness looks like in the context of a local church, even perhaps a young one.
Yeah.
What kind of difference does this make as a community in the body of Christ?
Yeah, I think about this question a lot just because it is so close to home for me. I very straightforwardly in the introduction admit I am not the person you want to listen to for advice on how to, you know, face death yourself in the moment from experience. Or for how to have a better bedside manner when you're helping care for others who are near death. And I don't have those experiences yet. But what I'm trying to do in the book is to prepare a community of people for solidarity under the reality of death that will protect us from seeing those who are dying imminently as some sort of special category of person. So one of the things that people who are suffering deeply and those who are facing death, and maybe it's especially acute for people who get terrible diagnoses early in their lives, they just feel so isolated from the community around them. When you're surrounded by people who are young and healthy and able to make the most of the lives they've got in front of them, and you know that that's not you, then it can deprive you of the very community support that you can't do without, that you need most in those times. And I think it also can be threatening and uncomfortable for someone who is healthy to be around someone who's not healthy if they don't know that they're also mortal. So what we're trying to do is to prepare ourselves to face the imminent reality of death in advance by just developing a better culture of awareness, so that all of us see ourselves as desperately dependent on the resurrection of Jesus for any hope in life and in death. So it isn't just death is not someone else's problem. It's all of ours. Now that's not to minimize that if someone's dealing with an imminent death, if they've got a stage 4 cancer diagnosis at 40 years old, of course there's got to be some pastoral sensitivity there. And that is a unique experience of death that needs to be heard, listened to, commemorated. It needs to be born. We need to bear witness to that and not minimize it because I'm dying anyway, as if that unique pain is not real and precious. That's not what I'm trying to say. But if those of us who are healthy confront those who are in the face of death and have nothing to throw at them but sort of cliches that we've never really had to depend on for ourselves, to cling to from our own desperate need for some deliverance, then they're going to be able to read right through that. And it'll actually just alienate us from them rather than drawing us closer to them. So we're trying to prepare ourselves to face death as a community in solidarity, where all of us know that we're all dying and Christ is everything or we are nothing. I don't use this image in the book, but I've always been really struck by that scene at the end of Pilgrim's Progress, where Christian and Hopeful reach they're within sight of the celestial city, but they've got the river between them and the city, and the river symbolizes death, of course, in the story. And they both launch out into it. There's no way to the city except through this river. But in the middle of it, as soon as they step out into that river, Christian loses his footing. He's bobbing up and down, fighting for breath. The waters are overcoming him, and he loses his hope. He doesn't think he's going to make it. He thinks this is going to be the end. But he's got his friend, Hopeful, right there beside him, reminding him of what's true, looking at what he can't see for himself, looking ahead to the city and to the shining ones who are coming down for him, and reminding him that the footing is there. I can feel it. We will make it through this. I think that kind of community of hopefulness is what I'm hoping to foster, and where I think death awareness can help us, because all of us are having to think about that together. It isn't just something we wait until our deathbed to think about. We think about that kind of hope now. I think it would make us more equipped to care for one another in the moment.
I don't know how you make a book about death beautiful, but Matt, you've accomplished that feat. So thank you. The new book, Remember Death, The Surprising Path to Living Hope, published by Crossway and the Gospel Coalition. Our guest has been Matt McCullough, author of Remember Death and pastor of Trinity Church in Nashville, Tennessee. Thank you, Matt.
Thanks, Colin. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Gospel Coalition podcast. For more gospel-centered resources, visit thegospelcoalition.org. Support for this podcast comes from listeners like you. Learn more and join us at tgc.org/donate.